What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, The Times gets Donald Trump Jr.'s emails about an offer from the Russian government. "I love it," he wrote. And what ISIS left behind. The streets of Mosul in the hours after the Iraqi government declared victory over the Islamic State. It's Wednesday, July 12th. Matt Apuzzo, it's Tuesday morning in the Times newsroom. What's happening?
We've got the emails, right? We've been searching for these emails for days. These are the emails between Donald Trump Jr. and Rob Goldstone, the friend who is going to set up this meeting at Trump Tower with a Russian lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
We're calling around and we're asking people for comment. And that means, of course, we call Don Jr. and say, "We have the emails. We want your comment. And we're going to publish. Your deadline is 11 a.m.
So he understands that 11 o'clock, boom, this big story is going to land.
Right. Exactly. There's no question. We told him we have to have a comment. And this shouldn't have been a surprise, right? They must have known somebody was going to get the emails. So we said, "You have until 11.
Okay. And then what happens?
Well, then he started tweeting, right? Then he goes on Twitter and starts publishing the emails himself.
And he did that at 11 a.m. the deadline.
Right.
Which means he was trying to self-publish around the New York Times.
Sure. And I mean, that's right. I mean, he had said he would send us a statement, and he did. He also sent the world a statement, which it wasn't beyond the realm of possibility, and it was certainly not something we hadn't considered.
Hmm.
I mean, the idea that Don Jr. would be on Twitter is certainly a realistic assumption of how this could go. So we had a story that was essentially ready to go. As soon as the tweet started coming, we published. And I don't even think he had finished tweeting out the string of emails before we published.
So, Matt, what does this email from Rob Goldstone to Donald Trump Jr. say?
Well, it's June 3rd, 2016, 10:36 a.m. "Good morning. Eamon just called and asked me to contact you with something very interesting. The Crown Prosecutor of Russia met with his father, Aris, this morning, and in their meeting, offered to provide the Trump campaign with some official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father. This is obviously very high level and sensitive information, but is part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump, helped along by Aris and Eamon.
Wow.
What do you think is the best way to handle this information, and would you be able to speak to Eamon about it directly? I can also send this info to your father via Rona, but it is ultra sensitive, so wanted to send to you first. Best, Rob Goldstone."
That's a hell of an email. So how long did it take for Donald Jr. to reply?
Minutes. And he's right on his email. "If it's what you say, I love it, especially later in the summer."
So Don Jr.'s response is, "I love this information, and in particular, I love it if it's available later in the year, in the summer."
Right, because of course, that's peak campaign time, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you get a bigger bump for damaging information. And they agree that Don Jr. will take a meeting at Trump Tower. And a Russian government lawyer will fly from Moscow and meet him at Trump Tower.
Hmm. So that's what we know now, which is entirely different than the story Don Jr. originally told when the Times began reporting the story on Saturday. Back then, he was describing this meeting as being about a U.S. adoption program that this Russian lawyer objected to. What is Don Jr. saying about it now?
Well, I think he's saying, "Hey, we're in the middle of a campaign. Somebody calls and offers me information. Of course I'm going to listen."
Mm-hmm.
It's politics. Any candidate would always listen to somebody who says he's got damaging information about a candidate.
Even from the Russian government?
Well, so the most innocent explanation here, right, is if you're in the Trump campaign and you say, we had no idea that the Russian government was in the midst of a hacking and propaganda campaign, then I can just take a meeting right. and ask for gossip. And only now, suddenly, everything Russian looks nefarious. That's the most charitable read on all this.
Right, right, right. The phrase Russian government didn't mean what it means now.
Right. And I think there's something to be said for that argument.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that the story keeps changing, right? The story keeps changing from nobody had any contacts with the Russians to, okay, there were some contacts with the Russians, but they've all been disclosed. And think about the number of people in the Trump world who have had to belatedly disclose mm-hmm. their contacts with somebody from Russia, whether it's Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions did not disclose meetings he had last year with Russian officials when he applied for a security clearance. Now, this
whether it's Michael Flynn, who resigned slash was fired as National Security Advisor.
Stepping down Monday night in a firestorm of criticism.
Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law.
Jared Kushner and Russia's ambassador to Washington discussed the possibility of setting up a secret and secure communications channel between Trump's transition team and the Kremlin.
Paul Manafort, the campaign chairman.
Paul Manafort secretly worked for a Russian billionaire to advance the interests of Russian President Vladimir Putin a decade ago.
So, I mean, it's just where we are today in 2017, knowing what we know about the Russian government's efforts to tip the election. It's made worse by the sort of repeatedly changing stories.
So back to the players. What is the Russian lawyer who was in the meeting saying now about it?
So she denies any sort of connection to the Kremlin or mm-hmm. Russia's efforts to meddle in the election. She denies being a conduit for any information. She says she came to do what she has basically been doing all along, which is trying to get the American government to repeal the Magnitsky Act, mm-hmm. a law issuing sanctions on Russia over human rights abuses.
So why would Rob Goldstone represent her, as he did in his email to Donald Jr., as showing up with information from the Russian government that would hurt Hillary Clinton? I mean, it doesn't seem like he would have much to gain from misrepresenting her, right?
Right. We don't know the answer. We do know that this was being passed through several layers, right? So was it a game of telephone? Was it a bit of puffery on Goldstone's part? Or was it true? And this was a back channel. This is what a back channel looks like. Somebody in one place wants to get information somewhere else but doesn't want to have their hands on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, okay, well, you know so-and-so who knows the people I need to get this information to. Can you be a conduit for that? So if information was passed, this is what a back channel looks like. But they deny that any information was passed. And we don't have any evidence that it was.
Right. Both sides. The Russian lawyer as well as Don Jr.
Right. And look, there's some circumstantial evidence to back that up. We know that Paul Manafort, the campaign chairman, and Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, were also in the meeting. We know that one of them left early, like within 10 minutes of the meeting starting. It was just gone. Now, if she were in there dishing dirt on Hillary Clinton,
you might stay.
What are the chances you'd just be like, hey, I gotta go. I got that 5 o'clock.
So, Matt, as someone who's been covering all of this for months, the ties between the campaign and Russia, how big of a deal is this development?
I think it's a really big deal because we now have a document saying there was a Russian government effort to help Donald Trump,
mm-hmm.
that somebody in the closest circles of the Trump campaign knew about and was willing to accept that help. Now, whether that help came or not, we now know those things for certain.
And that, Matt, brings us to a very familiar crossroads and a question I've asked you and several of our colleagues many times. Given what you just outlined, the offer, the explicit nature of a connection with the Russian government, and the enthusiasm for accepting it, are we talking about collusion?
I want to demystify the word collusion here.
Sure.
That word doesn't have power. Collusion isn't a crime, right? Collusion is just kind of a shorthand way people in Washington have described the question of, did anybody from the Trump campaign work with the Russian government to hurt Hillary Clinton. Right now, was it legal? Was it illegal? Was there computer crime, foreign bribery, all that other legal stuff is separate from the question. When you hear somebody talk about collusion, all you're basically asking is, was anybody from the Trump campaign in on it? And that is a separate question from, did anybody in the Trump campaign break the law? So just don't confuse collusion and I got it, collusion. Now everybody goes to jail. That's not how this works.
Matt, if collusion, as you just smartly suggested, is not a crime, why is that the word that keeps being used? Are you telling me we should basically retire it?
I mean, because conspiracy has such a, you know, so much baggage to it, right? Mm. I mean, what we're really talking about is I, as a reporter, am far less interested in trying to build a case. I'm actually not at all interested in building a case where somebody can point to an article in the New York Times and say, see, there is the evidence that will be used in such and such indictment. That's not what I do. Hmm. And it's not also what I think the role of a journalist is. So the question that drives me is, we know that the Russian government tried to mess around in the election. And so was anybody around the Trump campaign working kind of on the side to help that? It is a question about who's working behind the scenes to tip the balance of our democracy.
Right.
That's the question we're working with right now. The story of the 2016 election is still being written.
Matt, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I love it.
At what point did the president discuss with Donald Trump Jr. that meeting? Have you had a chance to get a sense of what he feels about this entire story as it continues to unfold?
On Tuesday, President Trump finally responded to the reporting in the Times through his White House spokeswoman, Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
I have a quick statement that I'll read from the president. My son is a high-quality person, and I applaud his transparency. And beyond that, I'm going to have to refer everything on this matter to John Jr.'s counsel and outside counsel and won't have anything else to add beyond that today.
A few hours later, Donald Trump Jr. spoke to Sean Hannity of Fox News.
In retrospect, I probably would have done things a little differently. Again, this is before the Russia mania. This is before they were building it up in the press. For me, this was opposition research. They had something, you know, maybe concrete evidence to all the stories I'd been hearing about, but they were probably underreported for, you know, years, not just during the campaign. So I think I wanted to hear it out.
We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for The New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray. And that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at the New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to the New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
In the days since Mosul was declared liberated from ISIS fighters, Rukmini Kalamaki has been venturing into the streets of its old city, where the final stages of the battle were fought, along with Daily producer Andy Mills.
What is the timeline of events that bring us from the beginning of the attempt to recapture the city up till now?
So in the middle of October of last year,
the final push is on tonight to clear ISIS from what was its key stronghold, the city of Mosul.
Iraqi and Kurdish troops descended on eastern Mosul and began the push to try to take back the city that at that point had a population that was larger than Philadelphia.
Iraqi and Kurdish forces have begun a military assault on the ISIL stronghold of Mosul in a battle some see as the jihadist group's last stand in Iraq.
They pushed in, and they were able to liberate the eastern half of the city by this January.
Today we celebrate the feast of victory and liberation, the liberation of East Mosul.
But
American-backed Iraqi forces are involved in fierce fighting with ISIS as they battle for the western half of Mosul.
The western side of the city, which was the second part of the battle, was the most difficult because that's the most dense part of the urban core.
This is the old city. The streets are small. The fighting there is house to house. ISIS have littered it with booby traps and with mines. And so now it's heavy urban guerrilla warfare.
So the battle ended up being both much longer and far more violent and deathly than anybody expected.
The effort to drive ISIS out of Mosul is now in its sixth month.
Casualty rates among some Iraqi units are at World War II levels.
A few thousand ISIS fighters pitted against tens of thousands of Iraqi troops and the full force of the U.S. coalition.
And 2 days ago,
they're jubilant in Mosul. They've driven the extremists out.
The Iraqi military declared victory.
Today, Iraq's prime minister declared victory over ISIS in Mosul.
But...
Hey, Hawk. When you hear that, it's outgoing? Outgoing.
You and I were in the city on the day, in the moment when that news alert moved on our phone.
The New York Times just says the Iraqi government claims Mosul has been taken.
And we could still hear airstrikes overhead and artillery and the tat-tat-tat of outgoing gunfire. And we weren't allowed to even approach the front because the Iraqi military said that it was too dangerous.
Rukmini is now climbing over pieces of what was once a tin roof, I believe. And there's a... Hey, smoke. You see this?
Holy shit.
That's close.
And we're now on the second day after that declaration. It's still ongoing, so pockets of resistance remain. So we're parked on a narrow street in western Mosul. The houses all around us have been destroyed. The windows have been blasted out. Rubble everywhere. Coils of rebar.
Could you just describe for people what it is like walking around there?
We just opened the doors to the car and immediately you could smell the stench of dead bodies. The old city of Mosul looks like the scene of an earthquake.
I mean, this is like... I don't know how to describe this. I mean, like, every single thing on the street is destroyed. Look at it. I mean, it's like...
Never seen anything like it.
Every single building that we go by has been destroyed, collapsed, pancaked.
Oh my God, it's an enormous hole. I mean, it like looks like the foundation of a skyscraper.
You walk past these enormous craters that are the size of, you know, maybe two stories, burrowed into the ground, that mark the spots where coalition bombs fell.
There's a building that appears to have been airstriked, and half of its facade has fallen off, but the other half is still holding.
I mean, it literally looks like the pictures I saw, the black and white pictures I saw from World War II, from Dresden, from Berlin, of these completely wiped out cities.
I mean, there's just... I don't even know how you begin to rebuild this.
So you have this gray landscape of destruction and death.
Yeah. Can you describe what we're seeing?
It's a total market that's been leveled to the ground, or what's left of it is just like debris and... There's nothing to be rebuilt.
Who is Hawk?
Hawk is our translator and fixer and my friend. And he is from Mosul. He grew up in the city. He went to its university. He taught in its schools as a teacher before becoming a contractor for the U.S. military and now a fixer for journalists.
So those dead bodies we just saw were human shields, probably?
Shields used as biases.
And he's been my guide, you know, on this journey. For him, this is not just a story. For him, this is the decimation of his hometown.
I can't tell where am I now. This is my city. I don't know where am I.
You don't even recognize it?
No. It's not recognizable. It's really hard for me to know which section I am in or which street I'm in.
At one point, we went into a building, and I realized that he had been arrested in that building. Could you tell me what were the grounds of his arrest and what do you know about that story?
Yeah. So Huck was fingered by a neighbor who knew him and who went to ISIS and pointed out that he had worked for U.S. forces. He was picked up by the religious police, the Hizbah, and driven to this building next to a church that had been turned into the headquarters of their morality police.
Huck, is this where you were kept? Yeah, they bring us here. They say, you sit. It was like four of us sitting here. We were sitting. Then they say we have to wait for the sheikh. The sheikh is like the judge of the Islamic State.
He was taken in to see a Sharia judge, and he was interrogated basically overnight.
So we were like waiting, but in anxiety and awareness is killing me.
And what had you heard they might do to you?
What would you think? Just kill me.
You thought you might die?
It's not about death. It's about very humiliated death, you know, by sheep.
He was extremely frightened that they would find out that he'd actually been working with the U.S. military for years.
So the desk was here. As I entered, there was a desk. There was another cushion here.
The reason he was able to hide that is because that work had been in Baghdad as opposed to in Mosul. He was then forced to sign a kind of confession, signing away saying that if he tried to leave the city, the punishment would be that a member of his family would be executed.
Did he not look you up? Like, did you have photos of you and soldiers you had worked with on Facebook or anything? Had he looked that up, would he have caught you?
Because I've never posted anything like this up till this moment. And I don't want in the future because it would be against me, as I am still in this country.
And this is why you won't let me use your real name?
Exactly.
And is it because you think they will maybe be back one day? Or
them or anything. As long as I'm in this country, everything is compromised.
So one of the interesting things about Hawk is I've worked extremely closely with him. We have, you know, slept on the rooftops of abandoned buildings on the outskirts of Mosul. We've seen pretty much every phase of this battle together. But even though his home has been liberated in eastern Mosul, he has never taken me home to see his wife or his kids. He doesn't want to be seen with Americans. He doesn't want to be seen texting on his phone in English. Texting.
Because the people now are a mixture of either they were supporters of ISIS members or people who have, they fear on themselves, they think that it's not secured yet. Mosul is not secured yet and it will never be.
Hawk knows this place as well as anyone, and he feels that there are infiltrators in his own neighborhood, just like the neighbor that fingered him to ISIS before. Those people are still there, and those people could someday come back and be in power again and harm him and his family.
It's not over with the defeat of ISIS caliphate troops, because they will always be there in some form, and they will be back in another version of, if not ISIS, something else. Because it's really hard to take off an ideology. It's very easy to take off troops, buildings, but thoughts and philosophy and ideology, this can live forever.
You're saying thoughts can live forever?
Thoughts, yeah.
All that suggests to me is that the city, even though in title it's perhaps now back under Iraqi rule, it is far from secure.
Here's what else you need to know today.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. The news of the day is that, as I think you already know, we'll be on health care next week.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is returning from the 4th of July holiday with a promise to introduce another version of his health care bill, with the current one facing too much opposition from within his own party.
We'll be laying out a revised version of the repeal and replace effort, the text of that. On Thursday morning,
Republicans can afford to lose just two votes on the bill, and 10 Republican senators said they wouldn't support it. McConnell's plan for passing the health care bill and the rest of his agenda will require that the Senate cut into its annual August recess, a step the Senate hasn't taken since 1994.
We will be in session the first 2 weeks of August. that we had originally anticipated not being here, we will be here.
That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.